Following our comments on William Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, Act 5, along with final reflections on the play. The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. Theseus reflects upon the kind of imaginative experience that generates such tales as the ones told by the play's two young couples. In Act 5, Scene 1, at the palace after the wedding feast, Theseus tells Hippolyta and his lords, the lovers will arrive after he speaks these words, that he will have none of this day's talk about fairyland-based, quote-unquote, antique fables, such as the now happy couples Hermia and Lysander and Helena and Demetrius have related to him about their strange time in the woods outside Athens. Act 5, Scene 1, Line 2. He comes across as a gentle but firm skeptic. Quote unquote, lovers and madmen have such seething brains, such shaping fantasies, that apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends. Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 4 through 6. In Theseus's view, quote unquote, the lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 7 through 8. He expounds farther that the poet's, quote unquote, imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown. And then his, quote unquote, pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 14 through 17. What has been imagined in the classical poetic frenzy, or, in Latin, furor poeticus, that is, will be given shape, definiteness, and order during the process of composition. Imagination, Theseus continues, is bound to provide causal agents for anything it treats. Quote unquote, in the night, imagining some fear, how easy is a bush supposed a bear? Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 21 through 22. Art, then, is one way people make sense of what our experiences and feelings give us to process. Hippolyta is somewhat less willing to downplay what she has heard from the lovers about their wild night in the forest. The collective story they have told, she thinks, quote unquote, more witnesseth than fancy's images and grows to something of great constancy. Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 25 through 26. As we would say in the wake of the television series The X-Files, the truth is out there. While Theseus may sound rather dismissive of the arts, he actually finds in them entertainment sufficient to, quote-unquote, ease the anguish of a torturing hour. Act 5, Scene 1, Line 37. That is no small thing in the present circumstances, as he, Hippolyta, and the other couples must endure a 3-hour waiting period before they retire to bed on their wedding night. For never anything can be amiss when simpleness and duty tender it. Theseus chooses Pyramus and Thisbe for the evening's entertainment. He appreciates the earnestness of the workmen actors. Still in Act 5, Scene 1, Theseus asks what's on the menu for tonight's entertainment. Philostrate rattles the items off. First, there are a few classically themed pieces, but as a mythic figure himself, Theseus doesn't need to hear that stuff again. There's also a satirical disquisition on, quote-unquote, the thrice three muses mourning for the death of learning. Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 52 through 53. That sort of thing isn't welcome either, says Theseus. As luck would have it, that leaves what Philostrate pans as a silly play, summarized as, quote-unquote, a tedious brief scene of young Pyramus and his love, Thisbe, Act 5, Scene 1, Lines 56 through 57. This play sounds anything but promising, but the illogical and whimsical PR blurb only piques the Duke's interest, as does Philostrate's admission that in rehearsal, the suicide of Pyramus affected him more than he thought possible. This act, he says, quote-unquote, made mine eyes water, But more merry tears the passion of loud laughter never shed. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 69 through 70. What sells Theseus on this particular play, though, is Philostrate's description of the men who would be acting it. These are, quote-unquote, hard-handed men that work in Athens here, which never labored in their minds till now. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 72 through 73. Theseus's response to this is noble in the best sense. Quote unquote, I will hear that play, for never anything can be amiss when simpleness and duty tender it. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 81 through 83. The players are honest, and they earnestly want to entertain. That should be good enough even for the elite audience that awaits the performance. Hippolyta is not convinced by this logic and worries that the workmen players will be humiliated. Not a whit, Theseus reassures her. We never get perfection in art, only effort with varying degrees of success. Quote unquote, our sport, he says, quote unquote, shall be to take what they mistake, and what poor duty cannot do. Noble respect takes it in might, not merit. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 90 through 92. A spectator should never be mean-spirited. Theseus promotes a gracious critical standard, one of a sort that has seldom prevailed from classical times to the present. Honest effort, he believes, should be rewarded. The best in this kind are but shadows. The workman's production is as silly as everyone thought it would be, and while the sophisticated audience mocks it, Theseus, as he's already said he would, respects the tradesman's sincere efforts. Still in Act 5, Scene 1. In spite of Theseus's kind words, things get off to a rocky start when Peter Quince butchers the pronunciation of a courtly prologue, which turns what he says into near nonsensical patter. Theseus, Lysander, and Hippolyta trade barbs at Quince's expense. In honor of Theseus's earlier generosity, though, it's probably best to set the speaker's tone to amused rather than meanly critical. Apparently nonplussed, if he even hears any of this tittering in the audience, Quince goes on to spill the entire plot, leaving no suspense for the presentation itself. The critical talk pipes down for a while as the play proceeds, with snout as wall, bottom as Pyramus, and flute as Thisbe, all gamely going about their business. Finally, Hippolyta can't hold silent and says, quote unquote, this is the silliest stuff that ever I heard, while in return, Theseus says, quote unquote, the best in this kind are but shadows, and the worst are no worse, if imagination amend them. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 207 through 209. As a statement of critical principle, this sounds like what many of us will take for Shakespeare's own wonderful combination of boldness and humility. Of course, where Shakespeare is concerned, just add genius and stir. Theseus is suggesting that a stage representation will always pale in comparison with real-life events and personages. But it will accomplish its ends if the audience steadfastly roots for the players to succeed. The spectator's generous imagination is the closest any artist can get to the prologue's famous Muse of Fire in Henry V, the one, quote-unquote, that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. What, then, are drama's objectives? Most likely, Shakespeare would have approved of the standard set forth by the Roman poet Horace, to be both utile, useful, and dulce, sweet, pleasant, entertaining. Or, as Philip Sidney puts it in an apology for poetry, the poet should, quote-unquote, teach and delight. Well, in comes Snug as the lion. Just as the workman had previously planned, Snug takes pains to ensure that the ladies will not be frightened. Quote-unquote, then know that I, as Snug the joiner, am a lion fell, nor else no lion's dam. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 218 through 219. His phrasing here is interesting in that the actor both steps forth as himself, Snug, and at the same time he is a ferocious lion. Or, if you please, and as the Norton editors aptly note, quote-unquote, a lion fell, which may mean either ferocious or a man in a lion's skin, since fell can be interpreted as fleece as well. Starveling enters as the man in the moon, with his lantern representing the moon, and then the noble audience cuts him off. In gentle mockery, so many times that he can only blurt out in exasperation, quote unquote, all that I have to say is to tell you that the lantern is the moon, I the man in the moon, this thorn bush, my thorn bush, and this dog, my dog. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 247 through 249. So there's that. Bottom next acts the lead-up to Pyramus's suicide, based on the misrecognized mantle that Thisbe dropped in her flight from the raging lion. Theseus finds this scene far from affecting, and says, quote unquote, this passion and the death of a dear friend would go near to make a man look sad. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 277 through 278. But Hippolyta disagrees, saying instead, quote unquote, beshrew my heart, but I pity the man. Act 5, Scene 1, line 279. Here, it is Hippolyta who seems closer to the generous critical precept that Theseus set forth before the beginning of Pyramus and Thisbe. Her inflection of that principle may remind us of Samuel Johnson's excellent observation in his Preface to Shakespeare, that we are moved by actions on the stage not because we are fooled into taking them for real events, but because they remind us of something real. Quote unquote, imitations produce pain or pleasure not because they are mistaken for realities, but because they bring realities to mind. Although the legends surrounding Theseus and Hippolyta are complex and varied, some of them say she suffered many losses during the Amazonian War, one of whom was her sister, Antiope. It may be that we are witnessing a difference in the sensibilities of these two strong-minded partners concerning the war and the deaths that overtook key participants. In any case, Pyramus bids the world goodbye with his trusty sword, wailing, quote unquote, tongue, lose thy light, moon, take thy flight, now die, 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 die. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 293 through 295. In short order, Thisbe does the same in similarly dreadful, choppy verses. In spite of the poetry's wretchedness, it isn't hard to see the appeal. Around the same time, circa 1595, Shakespeare authored Romeo and Juliet, another play that tells the story of young lovers whose destruction turns on tragic accidents and misrecognitions. Theseus lauds the players and tells them diplomatically that no epilogue will be needed, but a bergamask dance would be very welcome. If we shadows have offended, think but this, and all is mended. When the human couples have all gone to bed, the fairy king and queen and their helpers bless the marriages. In his epilogue, Robin Goodfellow asks the audience to be generous. Towards the end of Act 5, Scene 1, Robin Goodfellow, also known as Puck, offers a thrilling characterization of the fairies who serve Oberon and Titania as little creatures who live to the fullest at night. Quote unquote, and we fairies that do run by the triple Hecate's team from the presence of the sun, following darkness like a dream, now our frolic. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 369 through 373. It is Robin's present task to take his broom and, quote unquote, sweep the dust behind the door. Act 5, Scene 1, line 376. Titania and Oberon deliver their instructions to their fairy underlings, with orders to dance and to sing exactly what Oberon will go on to say. All that they do in Theseus, Hippolyta, and the other couple's wedding chambers will be designed to sanctify the unions of the mortals within them and render the offspring flowing from their acts of generation beautiful. Happy futurity is the theme. The fairies will spend the night fulfilling these obligations, which leaves Robin alone on the stage to speak an epilogue. In it, he invites the audience either to think of the play, if they don't care for it, as, quote-unquote, no more yielding but a dream, or, if they do like it, as an earnest promise of more fine performances to come. Act 5, Scene 1, Line 414. With that, Robin calls for applause, and the play is done. Final reflections on A Midsummer Night's Dream. To some degree like love itself, the theater, or make-believe, is a power in the world and one to be treated with due regard. At the end of A Midsummer Night's Dream, therefore, Robin Goodfellow begs indulgence for the play's excellent mockery of romantic desire as an irrational, chaos-inducing force that nonetheless seems conducive to individual happiness and good social order. The epilogue is effective, as Robin leaves matters to the audience's imagination. It is their prerogative to judge what they have seen, and their burden either to perpetuate the play in their own minds or decide to let it pass away. Shakespeare's conception of an ideal audience involves a certain active quality. They themselves must flesh out the representation and determine its value. On the whole, A Midsummer Night's Dream is a romantic comedy with a fairy-guided twist. This play may owe much of its success over the centuries to its way of dealing with passion in a curiously dispassionate, bemused, moonstruck manner. This fairyland perspective has already been captured by the time Robin says to Oberon in Act 3, Scene 2, quote-unquote, "Shall we their fond pageant see? Lord, what fools these mortals be." Act 3, Scene 2, lines 114 through 115. Shakespeare and his creations generously proceed to let us in on that divine, lordly perspective. We know that the chaste moon goddess Diana is looking over the whole affair from her distant perch up in the sky. In the end, as Theseus himself predicts midway in the play, quote-unquote, "The fierce vexation of a dream, the strife and confusion, will give way to spirit blessings and decorum." Act 4, Scene 1, lines 83 through 90 inclusive. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Sunday, July 6th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations from A Midsummer Night's Dream, I have relied on the revised Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.